There will be no personal nor direct attacks on anyone. And I would ask that you please try to keep down the loud cheering and the clapping. There will be no booing and no unruly behavior. With that,
this is painful, and it will be for a long time.
Donald Trump, baby! That's right, this man knows what's up!
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Well, Sean's a tough guy. I mean, I think everybody knows that. You know, Sean, he took some licks. He hangs in there.
Yeah, what's wrong with the beer we got? I mean, the beer we got drank pretty good, don't it?
Did you hear what I said?
So this is a brave council. I had no doubt about them.
That doesn't suck.
If you don't like it, too bad.
Last question. Were you high on drugs?
Last question. Kiss my...
And away we go. FM Talk 106.5 Midday Mobile. Glad to have you along on this Wednesday. Live local talk over the next hour. And joining us, Cameron Smith from the R Street Institute and AL.com. He'll be on shortly. But first, let's take you to the Southeast U.S., Atlantic Seaboard area, North Carolina, South Carolina now, and Virginia in the mix. Of course, we're talking about Hurricane Florence, some edits here and some changes since this morning, but they're still not good for those folks. Hurricane Florence barreling towards the Carolinas now is a Category 4 storm. North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper said more soldiers will be made available for residents' safety and to be able to clear roads because they are seeing, of course, lack of gasoline, crowded roadways as people are trying to evacuate. Here's the North Carolina Governor Cooper talking more about that.
North Carolina, my message is clear. Disaster is at the doorstep and is coming in. Plan to be without power for days. Understand that the rain may last for days and not hours. And this may be a marathon, not a sprint.
Yeah, they talking about the rain for days. Talk about flooding.
I've authorized more North Carolina National Guard soldiers to report for duty. By 7 p.m. today, 2,800 soldiers will be on active duty, joined by even more on standby.
All right, and what about that flooding issue? I'm talking to the manager here. Governors coordinating with city managers. I guess that's maybe their public safety director. That's what they call it in the Carolinas. I see a lot of city managers. This is Virginia Beach's city manager, David Hansen, commenting on Florence as well.
We will see some coastal flooding. There's no doubt when you have that much wind, that much push, and that much rain, though it's not excessive, it enters the moderate range of possible coastal flooding.
And that's up in Virginia. So now Charleston, as far south as Charleston, South Carolina, part of the discussion, and as far north as up into the Virginia coast. Here's what we're getting. This is coming from the folks in Wilmington, North Carolina, the CBS affiliate in Wilmington. Pretty good place, right? Couldn't be more ground zero on this. Said coastal residents fleeing a potentially devastating blow from Hurricane Florence encountered empty gasoline pumps and depleted store shelves as the monster storm. Although I think we saying monster a lot. The monster storm neared the Carolina coast, 140 mile per hour winds and drenching rain that could last for days. National Hurricane Center's Tropical Analysis and Forecast Branch said waves within the hurricane. Here's the one that stood out. Here's why I grabbed this story. Yeah, and Dalton, I don't know, you and I didn't even get to talk about this. Waves within this hurricane have been 80 feet plus. 80 feet high. According to, here it is, here's a quote, wave heights to 83 feet were measured early this morning under the northeast quadrant. Of course, that's the, you know, the roundhouse kick, that's the bad quadrant, the northeast quadrant of Hurricane Florence. These enormous waves are being produced and trapped along with very strong winds moving the same direction as the storm's motion. Now, they're doing this off the buoy information, I guess, before the buoys come loose. While some said they plan to stay put despite hurricane watches that include the homes of more than 5.4 million people on the East Coast, many weren't taking chances. And when we come back from the break, too, we will talk about the number of people and the number of pieces of infrastructure and homes and businesses in that area. And we'll do that with Cameron Smith, because we've talked about this before. There's a storm last year, the year before. Dalton, you and I were talking about going up the Florida coast, and I said, do you understand what the exposure could be for the insurance companies?
Mm.
Well, this is maybe not the same as going up through like Vero Beach, or, you know, Palm Beach up to Vero Beach and up to Jacksonville, but this is a very populated area along the coast, a lot of expensive homes, and you're looking at what could be a huge hit on the insurance companies.
80-foot waves.
83 feet.
Says, 83 feet waves.
83 feet
that's
in
insane.
The northeast quadrant. 83 feet wave heights. And so it's plural. So it's happening. Wave heights to 83 feet were measured early this morning.
And if you get a chance, I just retweeted a tweet from Alexander Gerst. He's a European astronaut that's currently on the International Space Station. And for events like this, I love checking out the pictures from the space station. But this most recent picture that he posted, he said, the hurricane is so enormous, we could only capture her with a super wide-angle lens. They're 400 kilometers above the eye of the storm in the space station. Had to use a wide-angle lens to fit the entire thing in the picture. Gerst wrote, get prepared on the East Coast. This is a no-kidding nightmare coming for you.
Yeah, this is, once again, and we'll get an update here shortly, but as of 5 o'clock this morning, the storm was centered 575 miles southeast of Cape Fear, North Carolina, moving at 17 miles an hour. They're also talking about it slowing even more as it gets to the coast, being that rainmaker and that floodmaker. But some of the things, just as a coastal guy, the rain's one thing, definitely a big issue, but I'm also looking at 83-foot high waves and what storm surge could be associated with that. They said between 10 and 20 feet. And you got to think of, number one, the barrier islands there. A little bit of a, not exactly like Dauphin Island is to Mobile County, but pretty similar. You have the Atlantic, you have a barrier island, you have a backwater, back bay, and mm-hmm. then you have the mainland. But that mainland in a lot of places is marsh or just a few feet above the height of sea level.
Right.
So when you start talking about 20 feet, which is two stories high, the number of buildings that could get inundated and then, of course, smashed by the power of water. There, and Chris was asking on the text line, crest to trough or wave height, half of that. Chris, I'm gonna guess, because those buoys would be similar to the way we run buoys here in the Gulf, right? I'm sure the same thing run by NOAA. That's crest to trough.
Okay.
So that's going to be the height, the way those buoys go up and down, how they figure out. Now, we all have our arguments. Our offshore fishermen, we have our arguments. How accurate? Because when they say, the waves are X, we say, well, you do that times this. But they're saying, according to buoy data, 83 feet, and that's got to be, if it's buoy data, crest to trough. Let me use a technical term here. That's stupid.
And they said they're putting all of our military assets, all the ships that we have out there. I wonder if those are riding out some of those massive waves. Probably not the 83-foot ones.
Yeah, hopefully they took the left turn and went up north there to stay out of it. I mean, that's one of the things that the Navy does. We saw it in Hawaii. We've seen it. They do not leave naval assets in harbor on a big storm because they get more damage there. They take them out and they go.
And we've heard and seen from Virginia and both of the Carolinas. And I imagine the state of Georgia was like, please, please, please don't. But now state of Georgia, their governor has declared a state of emergency for that state too. So even though it doesn't look like Georgia is going to get that first initial direct hit, some of the forecasts have Georgia catching some of the west side of the storm, but they have declared a state of emergency for Georgia.
Yeah, and they're talking about the rain being a thing. The rain associated with Florence being something we're talking about next week, into the early part of next week. So, I mean, it continues and continues and continues. All right. So, what about that? We'll talk a little more about the storm, but Cameron Smith's going to join us in just a second. And something we've talked about in the past is the exposure. Lord knows, we saw it here after Katrina, the dragging of the feet, insurance companies saying, oh, we can't deal with this amount of exposure. What about if, and it may go down to a one before it comes in, we don't know, but let's say you have 10 or 20 feet of storm surge. Let's say you have 30 inches of rain. The amount of damage and how wide that is, what does that mean for the insurance companies and federal flood insurance, National Flood Insurance Program? We'll talk about it with Cameron when we get back.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
No, I said wave heights to 83 feet. That's what they're reporting. This is from the CBS affiliate in Wilmington, North Carolina. It is, what are their calls? I don't even know what they call I don't know, CBS, yeah, CBS in Wilmington. I don't know, but they're saying that they have wave height. Here's a quote. Wave heights to 83 feet were measured early this morning under the northeast quadrant of Hurricane Florence. These enormous waves are produced by being trapped along with very strong winds moving in the same direction as the storm's motion. So there you go, 83 feet. Yikes. Even as, you know, coastal folks, that's an attention getter. And, you know, I mentioned this. We had talked about it 2 years ago. I know Dalton and I got in a conversation a couple of years ago. There was a storm, and I forget the name of it. We could Google it and figure it out. But it was to track up the, almost kind of ride up the east coast of Florida, not coming in at a 90 or a 45. It was almost going to go kind of just right up the coast. And I was saying, y'all realize the amount of property that's in there. Places like Miami, Fort Lauderdale, Palm Beach, Vero Beach, going on New Smyrna Beach, up to Jacksonville, all those properties there could be receiving damage. And what could that mean for flood insurance? What could it mean for insurance companies, private companies out there? We saw what happened after Katrina and heard the gnashing of teeth, and they would never recover from this. Now you're looking, I don't know that this is exactly the same, but you're looking at a situation where you have millions upon millions of people in this area of North Carolina, South Carolina, Virginia, that could be affected at different levels by Hurricane Florence. And what is that going to mean for the NFIP? What is that going to mean for the insurance companies out there? To come on and tell us more about that, our buddy Cameron Smith from the R Street Institute and AL.com. Hey, man.
Hey, Sean.
So, 83 feet. Did you see that? 83 foot wave.
Look. Put the Alabama offensive line out there, and everybody be fine. They can block that. Promise.
I'm proud of the O-line, but 83-foot wave, man. That's something. That is something.
Yeah. I mean, wow. I mean, just the thought of that. Wow. I mean, that is amazing.
And now you're looking at the coastline, and by the way, somebody pointing out, yeah, I try to put this out of my mind, today the 39th anniversary of Hurricane Frederick, which really knocked us for a loop here in 79. But you look at that coastline there in the Carolinas, and now there are exceptions, but generally you have the barrier island, a backwater, a bay of some sort, and then the mainland, but the mainland's often marshy or not too high above sea level, and they're talking about storm surge could be between 10 and 20 feet. So even houses that are built up, I mean, you come down, you hang out with us on Dolphin Island, you know, you build up above where you think the surge is going to be, but you start talking 20 feet, it's tough to stay out of the surge at that.
Yeah, I mean that's the tough thing about coastal areas. I mean, everybody who's American should like the beach. I feel strongly about that. I mean, it is one of God's most beautiful creations. People want to live there. I understand that. But we also need to be smart about it. I mean, all floodplains are not created equal.
Yep.
And Dolphin Island, even the difference between one end of the island and the other end is significant in terms of the impact of a storm surge. And I think the issue, our Street Institute works on a lot of these insurance issues, is we want to make sure that the market has the right incentives and frankly disincentives for people to build in risky areas and then have taxpayers on the hook to help them rebuild in areas we know where they're going to get hit again and again. We have the loss history for a lot of these properties that are covered by the National Flood Insurance Program, and frankly, a lot of it just looks silly to throw good money after bad when the problem is you've built in an area that you probably shouldn't.
Right, and they're exactly right. There are some people that have received flooding over the last decade that are 100-year, 200-year, 500-year floods. That's one level to talk about. But yes, there are people that build in areas that will, let's say, every 50 or 60 years get a big storm and destroy those properties. And I want people to have all the freedom to build where they want. They own private land. They want to do it. But making the taxpayers part of that, and this is tough to talk about in the coastal community, it can get you in trouble, but having the taxpayers backing all that, I don't know how much longer we can do it.
No, I think that's the challenge, is because essentially you're sending a price signal to somebody on the coast that, hey, you can build here more cheaply than you really ought to, because if you're in a 50-year floodplain, the flood insurance premium should be pretty high because you're taking on a lot of risk. That's not saying we don't like people, but like, for example, Last time I was in Dauphin Island, I was walking down the beach, and there towards the west end, I saw a house that the front poles of the house were in the surf normally, that the tide had come in, and the front part of the house was in the water. Well, guess what? If you get any storm surge, if you get particularly a high storm surge, that property is in trouble. That is a higher risk space. And so paying more in flood insurance premiums for that is completely reasonable, given the risk. Or somebody says, hey, we own this house outright. We know the risk is there. And if we get wiped out, we'll rebuild it ourselves. I'm fine with that, too. But the idea to ask taxpayers or ask others to insure against really significant risk is something that I just think it's not smart as a matter of public policy.
I'm talking to Cameron Smith with the R Street Institute and AL.com. And I will say, you know, the place that you've grown fond of, that I've been fond of for 3.5 decades plus, Dauphin Island, has some interesting issues when it comes to the sand down there on the west end that's being diverted by the ship channel, you know, when they dredge the ship channel. And that's a whole other issue. But yeah, let's talk. There are places that are definitely more prone to getting damage from storm surge. NFIP, if people haven't dealt with it, because not everybody has a property there, how does this work? I mean, how's the program work?
Well, I mean, basically you have a situation where the market would not otherwise bear the flood insurance risk. And so folks would struggle to get policies that would allow them to build in certain areas. For me, as a market-oriented person, that seems to make sense to me, that if you want to build in a certain area and you want to have it insured, there's a super premium there because of the risk. Well, the National Flood Insurance Program comes in and essentially levelizes that and says, okay, well, here's going to be the premium. It's essentially subsidized by taxpayers. So it's much more reasonable. Think of it almost as an insurer of last resort, saying no one else is going to insure this. So we've got a government program that will step in. The problem is, by virtue of the fact it's there, it creates a market anomaly where people are essentially buying below market insurance for highly risky properties, and the burden is shifted to the taxpayer. I mean, that's the long and short of, and to be fair, that's an oversimplified version, but for the purposes of radio, there's NFIP ratings, like communities can do certain things to mitigate flood risk that can change some of the dynamics. Bottom line is, this is a program where instead of the market saying we'll insure these properties in this way, the government comes in and essentially subsidizes the structure for people in vulnerable areas.
And to make sure all sides are heard on this too, if I'm, you know, in a coastal community, and you know, for all declaration here, so I have a dog in the hunt. We, you know, lucky to have a place to use on Dauphin Island that we go to. So I have a dog in the hunt. But if you're a coastal community, wherever, if it's here in Alabama or if it's in South Carolina, North Carolina, you will argue that I'm sure so much of your tax base is dependent on property taxes of those very nice properties that are built on the water, right? So if you pull this rug out from under all these things that have been built there, they're going to be abandoned. People won't make their payments. It'll be a crash in that market.
Yeah, and I've heard that argument. I've also heard the argument of, hey, these coastal areas generate a ton of tourism dollars.
It's true.
Orange Beach, Gulf Shores, those are areas where you're generating a lot of revenue in terms of the state. The state enjoys the revenue that's generated there, particularly over the summer and in peak times.
Yeah.
So, the taxpayer has to subsidize this program indirectly, but
have you ever
looked at all the benefit of having somebody down there to generate all that revenue?
Have you ever run those numbers at R Street, like where you would look, let's say, take a 10-year window, and of course, the anomaly of when storm hits, but if you can get some kind of average there of a decade and look at what the tax revenue is from those coastal communities, and then kind of model out what you think the structures would be if you did not have NFIP, and balance out, are you dollar ahead with the 10 years of tax revenue and then having to pay out every decade, or are you better off not subsidizing, even though on a straight academic level, I'm with you because I don't like, you know, I get the government out of as many things as possible.
Well, in terms of, I don't believe that we've done a product looking at sort of, okay, here's all the economic activity down here, here's the revenue generated by these areas, and, you know, here's the loss history. And we've looked a lot at the loss history, but in terms of the net out, I don't think that we've done a study along those lines. There's also the challenge of, you know, the state and federal breakdown of, you've got the National Flood Insurance Program. Right. This is a national program.
And you got
so it's not a situation where, you know, in Alabama, there's a coastal area. In Florida, there's a lot of coastal areas. In Louisiana, tons of, like, more than 7,000 miles of coast all in Louisiana. Well, in those areas, they're saying, wait a minute, this is really good for us in terms of it makes coastal living more affordable. And guess what? The fact, you know, people in Nebraska get to subsidize it? Okay. I mean, I think that there's some of that that happens. It's just a pure political reality. But sure, anytime you talk about any reforms to these programs, like NFIP, expanding Coastal Barrier Resources Act, covering, you know, high-risk areas, which CBRA basically says, we just don't spend any federal money or provide federal support in these certain areas that are risky. That's a very conservative idea in terms of a conservation policy.
Let's do this.
Man,
yeah, hold on to that thought.
About a golf course or something.
Hold on to that thought. We're coming right back. Head to the news break here. Back with more from Cameron on Midday Mobile.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
At 12:35, FM Talk 106.5 and Midday Mobile. Glad to have you here on this Wednesday and watching a beast of a storm heading towards the Carolina-Virginia coast, although they're saying now maybe a southerly turn. It could be affecting Charleston. We'll wait to see. More from Dr. Bill coming up right here on FM Talk 106.5. Also, continue our conversation with Cameron Smith from the R Street Institute and AL.com. And Lord knows we were jabbering there during the news break about a lot of this, because I do find this interesting. It would be easy for me to completely homer up here because I have a dog in the hunt and I'm a coastal guy and I appreciate it and just say la 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 la. I don't want to hear it. But these are real, true things. And I know on the text line, people are saying, well, that NFIP is, welfare for wealthy people. People saying, you pay, you play. Don't ask me to pay for your risk. This one from Steve says, the state benefits. How about the property owners? Are you going to mention that? Oh, you got me, Steve. I would never mention that. Rental income, property appreciation. What we're talking about here is a program that distorts the market in insurance, right?
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, we're looking at the affordability question of insurance, but the reason the program exists in the first place is because if it were left up to the market, the policies would be really high because the risk is really high.
You mentioned, you mentioned before the break, CBRA. What is that?
The Coastal Barrier Resources Act was, I believe it was in the 80s, but ultimately it was a conservation-type program that said, hey, these are certain environmentally sensitive areas. Instead of throwing subsidies at them or creating mandates, one of the things we're going to do is these are federal government subsidy-free zones that the federal government isn't going to spend money or subsidize building and activity here because these are environmentally sensitive areas. It's a very conservative environmental policy. The idea being, all we're telling you is that federal programs that make things more affordable or subsidize activities don't apply in these certain mapped areas. That makes a lot of sense to me because we don't want federal money to be spent in areas that it's going to be wiped out in 50 years. We want a situation where we're making good investments. CBRA has a series of maps that basically creates government subsidy-free zones.
All right. Let's say we do what you're talking about, and we go to a new tomorrow here with the NFIP being pulled back, either at some percentage or entirely. The argument will be that, all right, I have a property on the water right now. I bought the property with NFIP in place. You change this, you have changed the whole structure on me. The reason I bought the house, the reason I did this was NFIP. So what do you tell those people, and how do you get from that, the situation today, to a situation where we are not incentivizing, you know, we're not paying for, we're not subsidizing that, you know, that insurance payment?
Sure. I mean, the answer on a lot of these things is it's got to be gradual. You know, that's an immediate policy response. There's also the rip the Band-Aid approach. I think the ripping the Band-Aid off approach and just going cold turkey is politically very, very challenging. Think about this as analogous to the Farm Bill insurance subsidies. The Farm Bill is a New Deal program that has been around for a long time, and those are market subsidies. It's subsidizing mm-hmm. certain behaviors and crops and activities and things like that. This is subsidizing living in risky flood areas. And that's basically what's there. And so weaning people off of that, I get it. Once people get government cheese or government subsidies, they want to keep them. And I understand why, because it's basically saying other people need to bear the risk for your market activity. But one of the things that I've heard is, well, nobody's subsidizing, you know, tornado insurance. Like, there are lots of events that we could subsidize the risk.
Well, let me just be cynical. It's because
we make that decision?
Well, because there's not dollars there, right? I mean, I'm just going to say what needs to be said. And the reason probably there hasn't been the push for some kind of tornado alley zone is the revenue wasn't there for, you know, for local government and state government.
Well, sure, but I mean, it goes to the point of a subsidy.
I agree with you. I'm just saying why it happened.
I'm going to subsidize your tornado, your homeowner's insurance. We're going to subsidize this because you're in a very risky tornado area. And then we tell them, actually, we're going to let the market work properly, and you're just going to pay a higher premium because you're in a riskier area. That's a reality. I mean, people in riskier areas pay higher homeowner's insurance premiums, even if the flood damage aside. For, hey, we know there's a lot of risk here. There's a lot of, it's a tornado alley, if you will. That's a reality that the market has enacted. And the idea that if we decided we want to subsidize that to make homeowners insurance more affordable, we could. But then you run into the same problem. People say, well, we like the subsidy. We depend on it. There's economic ramifications of removing it. So we must continue. And that's frankly where we are with NFIP.
All right, let's jump from there real quickly into private insurance, and from NFIP into those companies that we will hear. I'm sure they're sweating right now, looking over actuarial tables there for the insurance companies that have the private insurance on the homes and businesses and all those things in South Carolina, North Carolina, Virginia.
Yeah, I mean, I would be sweating too, because that's lost. But it's also important to remember, and a lot of people forget this, that there's not, these companies more often than not are not insurers who are sitting there and they're sitting on a pot of money, and then if bad things happen, they pay out of the pot. These insurers reinsure. There are multiple layers of this to essentially diversify the risk. And that is what's, you know, fascinating and complicated about the marketplace that a lot of people don't realize, is that they're in the business of managing risk. We hear the phrase actuarially sound insurance policies. Mm-hmm. What that means is the market needs to be able to price risk appropriately. Actuaries are very, very good, particularly with technology. Some of the products that they have now, I mean, they can price risk for just about anything.
Then why do we put up with them? I mean, post Katrina, and I don't have all the names in front of me, but there were quite a few insurers out there that said, "Oh, well, we have to have some kind of bailout, some kind of subsidy. We're not going to be able to pay all these premiums." At that point, I have no sympathy. I am a free market person, but you made a deal, you made a contract that if I pay you the premiums, then you pay off if I have a loss.
Yeah, and frankly, it wipes out a lot of insurance companies. That hey, if you say you're going to cover the loss and that's the deal that we have, and you can't cover it, then you're toast. And, you know, your business is upended, and we saw some of that with Hurricane Katrina. And that is how the market does indeed work. It's a matter of preparation. The challenge is when you have a major event, a Katrina-style event, those are generational events. Those are not the typical run-of-the-mill things. And appropriately pricing a product that's competitive but also prepares for the risk. I mean, for example, one of the things that Alabama Power always talks about is, well, in Alabama, you know, we've got generation capacity for, you know, a 500-year winter or something like that. Well, the question is, do you really need it? Probably not. We probably don't need to pay for that. But in the event that you get a 500-year winter, you're really going to wish you had it. And that's the challenge here with a lot of these insurance setups is, you know, they're pricing risks. They're trying to make sound decisions, but some risks, you know, are frankly unexpected and extremely large.
All right. Just joining us, talking to Cameron Smith, one of his gigs, R Street Institute. This is something y'all do a lot and look at this insurance policy. And I think we'll probably talk more about this next week on the backside of Hurricane Florence. The other thing you do is talk, you know, talk politics with us and talk shop. And you wrote you sent a text to me here. And this is interesting because I've heard, you know, everything from the sky is truly falling in the midterms for Republicans to everything's going to be just fine. I looked at it the other day. I mean, if you go the old James Carville idea here and say it's economy stupid, you would say then why wouldn't the Republicans be fine in the midterm? So, you jotted a note to me and said why Republican incumbents feel like they're not afraid, that they're safe.
Yeah, and I think to clarify the context, what I've seen a lot in Alabama has been Democrats saying, ooh, the Republicans are scared. They're scared about this blue wave that's coming. Let me be clear. In Alabama, no, they're not. I don't know of a single Republican on certainly not on the federal level, who's sitting there shaking in their boots saying, my Democratic challenger is really going to tear me up. Scabby, certainly not.
Right.
And I think that it's important to remember context. I think Alabama is very different. A lot of the Southeast is very different. You're seeing a situation, though, where the more you get into toss-up land, for example, in Tennessee, Phil Bredesen versus Marsha Blackburn. Well, you're looking at a Senate seat there that kind of has the feeling of like the Doug Jones, Roy Moore thing, not necessarily with the comparison to personalities, but certainly a competitive race in a state that's, you know, again, Tennessee is fairly Republican. And so what the bigger concern is not really even the Senate, it's the House. You have lots of toss-ups. I think the last count, there were 44 toss-up races in the House of Representatives. They may not be in Alabama, but it's just a very tough defensive map for Republicans right now. And so while certain incumbents are frankly nonplussed by all of this and don't really, you know, see a scare factor from a Democratic opponent, I do think there's a very real chance, if not a probability, that Republicans do lose the House. They have a favorable Senate map, and so I think they probably keep the Senate. But the House is very, very much in jeopardy, and even though the economy is doing well, when you have swing seats and you have a motivated base in terms of where the Democrats are right now, That drives votes, and that's a big deal right now.
It must be all based on turnout, because if the same people showed up to vote as did in 2016, you would imagine that they would show up and say, yeah, the economy is doing great. I'm not going to change anything here. Even, you know, some swing voters would look and say, oh, so my paycheck's better. Unemployment's down. The market's jamming along. You know, more of that, please.
Yeah, and I think that you're right in a presidential. I think this is the difference in a midterm. You got lower turnouts in a midterm anyway, because you don't have all the ad dollars that go with the presidential election. And as Carville pointed out, it's the economy stupid. When you're talking about a presidential race, there's a nexus there. They tie the president to the economy generally, even though that's kind of stupid. I mean, our
economy, you pointed that out,
$20 trillion.
Yeah.
The president doesn't dictate it, but that's the narrative, and that drives a lot of participation. We just won't have that at the midterm. Trump, I don't care if you love Trump, Trump is not on the ballot, and that would get a lot of people to the polls. And conversely, Hillary Clinton is not on the ballot, which I believe suppressed some Democratic turnout in terms of people not excited about her. So you've got a broad variety of candidates running for office. You don't have Trump pulling people out for Republicans like you would if he's on the ballot. that may not be a great combination for Republicans.
There he is, folks. Cameron Smith, R Street Institute and AL.com. People want to get in touch with you, talk, whether it's flood insurance policy or politics, how do they do it?
Well, first of all, they can invite me to their federally insured beach house, and I'm happy to have conversations there. But you can also find me at AL.com/opinion or on Twitter at D. Cameron Smith.
All right. You're still welcome on the island with us anytime, man. Anytime.
Thank you, Sean.
All right. 1250 FM Talk 106.5. Midday Mobile on this Wednesday. Glad you're along. Remember, online at FMTalk1065.com. Stream us there. Also stream us through the TuneIn Radio app. It's free. Available for your Apple. Even if you got one of those new Apples they debuted today, you could use it there. Through the iTunes Store, or for good old-fashioned Android users like me, just go to Google Play.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
At 1252 FM Talk 106.5. Grab a couple calls and some text here. Also, I want to grab this call from my buddy Angelo at Mobile Bay Coins and Fine Jewelry and see what's going on at the shop on a Wednesday. Hey, man.
Hey, how's it been going?
It's going good. Let's talk about a couple things here. Last time you talked with us last week, you said this was the time to make a move on silver because the prices were pretty fantastic.
Well, it certainly is. Silver is still hovering around $14 an ounce, starting to climb again. We've noticed over the last few days the supplies have dried up, so people are actually raising the premiums on silver bullion, just simply not available. That's that whole supply and demand sort of thing. So,
right.
Yeah, this is the bottom point of the market, and if you want to get in, this is really the best time to do it.
Okay, so, and you've told me that in the past, even when prices were higher, you said, because you and I were talking, you said silver was, there was, is it more margin? Is that the right term in silver than there was in gold, or you just thought that was a better move?
Well, it's a better move. There's been a lot more activity with silver, because silver has been as high as $49 and some change per ounce, and as low as $13 or $14 an ounce in recent years. So if you bought it right and then sold it right, you would have had a really fine chance of making it better than three times your money.
Nice. Speaking of silver, I'm looking at a coin you've got up on y'all's Facebook page, the Pony Express Rider here. Tell me about that coin.
I'm so glad you mentioned that one, because that one I actually have plenty of in stock. That's the Western Series. Now, 10 coins in the series. So there's now the Prospector, a Gunslinger, and now the Pony Express Rider. We've got all of those in stock. Some of the items we put up on our Facebook page are one-offs, one and done. We had a true Alabama silver round put on there the other day for the 92 championship. I had one available, and it sold in less than a minute.
That's moving fast. All right. Also, other gift items. Let's talk jewelry, open-all knives. What else you got for us?
Well, a lot of silver jewelry. Anna's been doing a lot with the Sterling. A lot of bangle bracelets in stock. We've restocked the open-L knives again, added a couple new knives other than the open-Ls, and also a lot of sharpeners. We had a lot of people asking, hey, I've had this open-L for a couple of years. It's still got a good edge, but it's starting to get a little dull. Now we've got some sharpeners for you, too.
All right. Give us directions to come see you.
Yeah, we're in Midtown at 2204 Government Street. You can always call us at 725-1590. Or if you want to browse from the comfort of your own home, go on to Facebook and like and follow Mobile Bay Coins there.
There we go. Thank you, Angelo.
Have a good one, Sean.
You too. All right. 1255 FM Talk 106.5. A couple texts coming in here. Steve says, I do agree with you. The Dolphin Islands being robbed of sand by the ship channel dredging, and that's something that needs to be done about that. Yeah, I just wanted to throw that in because Cameron, who does a pretty darn good job for a guy living in the northern part of the state, right, for understanding things on the coast, and maybe it's because he gets to come down and go fishing with us each year and hang out, but I wanted him to understand, too, those homes on the west end of Dolphin Island that have the water coming up to their pilings, that's happening because the sand is not being delivered on the island where it was. And by the way, too, you'll look at our Facebook page, pretty interesting graphic. I think a 50-year cycle, it showed what is Pelican Island. I grew up calling it Sand Island, too, but I guess officially it's Pelican Island. The migration of that to hook in with Dolphin Island. You know, now, of course, Dolphin Island Pier has long since had sand under it and all that. You can see this little timeline that shows that sand moving. What that sand is doing is doing what it's supposed to do, move from east to west and slightly north. That gives you a good example of what would normally be happening with the rest of the sand that's getting deposited further offshore from the dredging project. And once again, this is not a not ever been a negative thing on deepening, widening, and straightening the ship channel. I'm all pro our port, and although I do understand some oyster folks are worried about what might happen here. But I'm pro our port. I'm just saying if we are going to dredge the sand, just let it hop over the channel and go to Dolphin Island where it's supposed to. That's a little different than the NFIP thing, and we're going to hear a lot more. I bet you're hearing it on the show today. Nobody else is talking about it, but next week, week after, depends on... No, I think even if it comes in as a Category 1, even if Florence comes in as a 1 to the Carolina coast, you'll hear a lot of discussion on whether we continue to run a program that they that artificially changes the insurance market on the coast. It's an interesting discussion going forward. It will always pop up. Here's what happens. It's something we should be talking about when we're not just on the backside of a storm. You know what I'm saying? These stories come up. Hey, there were so many of these discussions right after Katrina or the year after Katrina, and then they go away and nobody thinks about them. Nobody wants to talk about them. You can't even get attention for them. You can get attention for them in the years after, but then we'll have another storm, something will happen, then it'll be subject du jour again, and then it'll go away, then it'll come back. Somebody asking, where is the... Okay, yeah, so the video I'm talking about, which is actually not truly a video, it's like you do... Remember, did y'all used to do cartoons with the paper where you draw a stick figure and make them move and then flip through the pages? It's that kind of animation here of many, many years of satellite and overhead images of Dolphin Island. It is on our Facebook page, facebook.com/FMTalk1065. I posted it up. Yesterday morning, I posted this up, so y'all can check this out. Go look at it, and it gives you an idea of the fact that it's not a static environment when you look at the sand along the barrier islands. Hour number 2 of Midday Mobile, if I can make it through. Coming up next, I think I have the Hanta virus or something, but we'll see. Coming right back. We'll be right back.